This Week in Nuclear, episode 36, November 19th, 2006. Welcome to the show. I'm John Wheeler, and you're listening to episode number 36 of This Week in Nuclear. I'm just back from the American Nuclear Society winter meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and what a great conference. I'll cover some of the highlights later. First, I want to cover some of the big news this week, and I'll discuss the midterm elections in the USA and how the results might affect the nuclear industry. On Monday, General Electric Nuclear Energy and Hitachi announced that they're forming a joint venture to market new nuclear plants and nuclear services around the world. The new enterprise, in my mind, is the most creative in a string of similar unions that have sprung up over the last several months. Hitachi will hold 80% of a joint company held in Japan, where GE hopes to get in on new business there. And GE will control 60% of the global venture in the USA and elsewhere outside of Japan. This unique arrangement leverages the strengths and relationships of each company where they're needed most. And I take my hat off to Andy White of GE Nuclear and Kazuo Furukawa of Hitachi for coming up with a winning concept. Hitachi's recent nuclear plant construction experience and supply chain will be an asset to GE, and GE's ESBWR and ABWR offerings and their nuclear service infrastructure will give Hitachi a leg up in Japan's market. I hope to cover the GE-Hitachi joint venture in more detail in a future show. So the nuclear teams have lined up like this. Toshiba with Westinghouse promoting the AP1000, Mitsubishi with Areva marketing the EPR, and Hitachi with GE offering the ABWR and ESBWR, as well as Hitachi's PWR designs. These companies are all poised to compete for hundreds of billions of dollars in new nuclear plant construction around the world. The other major players are AECL of Canada and Adamstroy Export of Russia, both serious competitors when it comes to smaller or lower cost units. India and China have also thrown their respective hats into the ring, but I doubt they'll capture much more than a small fraction of the world market. I'm betting they partner with others to strengthen their position. For example, Canada and India might partner on advanced CANDU technology. One thing's for sure, though, this business is about to heat up. And just in time, this week the International Energy Agency released their 2006 World Energy Outlook, and the results are striking. World energy demand will grow by 53% in the next 24 years. 70% of the growth will be in developing countries led by China and India. World demand for oil will rise from 84 million barrels per day in 2005 to 116 million barrels per day by 2030. And most of the increase in production will come from a small number of Mideastern nations. Along with that increase in oil consumption will come more political leverage wielded by nations in unstable regions of the world, those with fundamentalist Islamic governments and questionable human rights records. And oil prices will be unstable and will continue to rise over the long run. Here's a short audio clip from Platts News podcast that discusses the world energy outlook.
Hello, I'm Joel Hanley. I'm the manager of the European Crude Desk in London, and I'm here to discuss this week's publication of the IEA's World Energy Outlook publication. I'm here today discussing it with Waleed Kurdi, who is one of the editors on the London Crude Desk. Waleed, what were the main points of the IEA's World Energy Outlook 2006?
Thanks, Joel. The report draws fairly gloomy picture for the energy market regarding the environmental impact, especially of the use of fossil fuels. It confirms that fossil fuel demand and trade flows, in addition to greenhouse gas emissions, would follow their current unsustainable paths through to 2030 in the absence of new government action. In addition to the environmental factor, the IEA was concerned about the low level of investment in production capacity around the world and the rise in demand, mainly from developing countries, particularly China.
So in this publication, what was the IEA's view on future demand and supply?
The IEA believes that demand would grow by more than one quarter in the period up to 2015 alone. Over 70% of the increase in demand over the projection period comes from developing countries, with China alone accounting to about 30% of that. Their economies and population grow much faster than in the OECD, shifting the center of gravity of global energy demand. On the supply side, the IEA expects supply by 2030 to be dominated by the Middle East countries and Russia, with implications on prices as a result. The IEA said that the concentration of production in a small number of countries, which are geopolitically unstable, may lead to sharp volatility in prices. The situation will also lead to more leverage for those countries to influence prices.
Right, so what is the impact on prices in the IEA's view?
They have a number of scenarios, but the most interesting one is that the IEA revised upwards their assumptions for oil prices in this outlook. I mean, the revision comes in comparison to last year's prices or outlook. The IEA expects that crude oil and refined product markets will remain tight. Market fundamentals point to a modest easing of prices as new capacity comes on stream and demand growth slows. But new geopolitical tensions, or worse, a major supply disruption, could drive prices even higher. The IEA assumes that the average crude oil import prices could fall back to $47 per barrel in real terms in the early part of the next decade, and then rise steadily through to 2030. The IEA expects that more than half of all the energy investment needed worldwide is in developing countries, where demand and production increase is expected to be most quickly. China alone needs to invest about $3.7 trillion, which is 18% of the world total. There is no guarantee, of course, that all of the investment needed will be forthcoming. Government policies, geopolitical factors, unexpected changes in unit costs and prices, and new technology could all affect the opportunities and incentives for private and publicly owned companies to invest in different parts of various energy supply chains.
You just heard a clip from Platts Oil Podcast. It's a good source of information about the oil and gas industry, and they occasionally include broader energy industry news. You can find it on iTunes or by searching for Platts Oil Podcast. I've also put a link to the podcast in the show notes. The 2006 World Energy Outlook is an independent report that highlights the vital importance of investing in nuclear energy, energy conservation, and other sustainable energy sources. Without this investment, coupled with focused national policies, CO2 gas emissions will continue to rise and the world's reliance on oil will continue to grow. With that reliance on oil will come political instability and conflicts. Every nation of the world needs to become energy self-sufficient to the maximum extent possible, and nuclear energy can play a huge role in allowing that to happen. The Democratic Party's overwhelming victory in last week's U.S. national elections could have a profound effect on the nuclear industry, but it's not all doom and gloom. For the benefit of my international listeners, before I go into the details of the changes in Congress and how they might affect the industry, I'd like to review how the U.S. Congress functions and how laws are created and ratified in the United States. Understanding this process is valuable in recognizing the potential impact of the new Congress, particularly in roles of congressional committees and committee chairmen. The U.S. Congress is divided into two houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate. The political party with the majority in each house has the right to appoint committee chairmen. So in the new Congress, the chairman of all the committees in both the Senate and the House of Representatives will be from the Democratic Party. New laws or changes to existing laws can be proposed by any member of either house, but these bills, as they're called, have to be approved by committees in both houses before they can be voted on by Congress. When laws are proposed, they go to congressional committees for debate and to be drafted into legislation. Committees can elect not to consider legislation at all, in which case the bill dies before it goes anywhere. Committee chairmen, of course, have a lot of influence on what bills the committees pay attention to and in the direction the debates go. Committees in both houses debate bills separately, If a committee concludes that a proposal deserves to be voted on by the full House, then the bill is sent for a full vote. Bills have to be approved by committees in both houses, then approved by a vote in both houses. After a bill is approved by both houses, the next step is to eliminate any differences between the two versions. After final ratification by the Congress, the bill is sent to the President to be signed into law or vetoed. If the President chooses to veto the bill or disapprove it, the vetoes can be overturned by a two-thirds majority vote by both houses of Congress. You might say that Congress has unlimited authority to propose change, but little authority to actually approve change, because with only a slight majority in Congress, the Democrats don't have the power to override a presidential veto. By contrast, the President has almost unlimited authority to stop changes, but no authority to initiate them. In addition, Congress holds the purse strings and has to approve budgets and funding, which, of course, gives them the ability to shut down programs without formally killing them. Even if a program has been previously approved, they can decide to sit on the funding request. If they don't appropriate the funds, then the program starves to death. So in a nutshell, if either party wants to pass any changes to any laws or any new laws, then they'll have to cooperate with one another. So for at least the next 2 years, the Democrats will have a slight majority in both houses of Congress, which means they'll appoint chairman of all the committees, and thus will control the legislative agenda and the budgets. If anything is to get done in the new Congress, then two parties have to work together, because while the Democrats control the legislative agenda and the funding, the Republicans hold the veto power. The majority leaders of the House's Senator Harry Reid of Nevada and Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi from California will assume majority leader positions in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and they'll have tremendous influence on what Congress does or doesn't do. The change with the most impact for the nuclear industry on the national scale is Nevada Senator Harry Reid's assuming the influential role of Senate Majority Leader. Senator Reid is, of course, outspokenly anti-nuclear, and he's leading the legislative attack on Yucca Mountain. He's likely to do everything in his power to kill the project while sucking as much money out of the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust Fund as he can. He's tried to do that before. In fact, his state has been the recipient of billions of dollars that have already been spent on Yucca Mountain. A good chunk of that has been legal fees paid to his lawyer buddies back home in Nevada. In an earlier episode of This Week in Nuclear, I told you about a bill he proposed earlier this year that would divert money from the decommissioning fund to other projects. The bill died in committee under the current Congress, but I expect it to resurface because now he has the power to do so. More and more, Harry Reid finds himself at odds with his party over the issue of greenhouse gas emissions. The Democratic Party recognizes that only nuclear energy can provide large-scale, cost-effective baseload power without CO2, and that's bringing them around to support nuclear energy. Nancy Pelosi, for example, is a lot more open-minded about the role nuclear energy will play in our future. Just recently, she was quoted as saying the U.S. needs to consider nuclear energy as one of the ways we can fight global warming and reduce our nation's reliance on foreign oil. Some other influential Democratic members of Congress have also begun to move away from their prior positions of strong opposition to nuclear and towards even supporting it. I've been pretty critical of Hillary Clinton on past shows, and for good reason, but even she is moving cautiously towards recognizing the USA has to expand nuclear energy's role. I've also heard that Senator Ted Kennedy said something to the effect that perhaps he's been wrong all these years about nuclear energy, but I've been unable to confirm that story. Other changes include Barbara Boxer, a liberal Democrat from California, who will become the chairman of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. One note here, this position would have been held by independent Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut if he'd not been forced to ditch his party affiliation in that much-publicized election. As an independent, he loses the opportunity to serve as a committee chairman, one of the inequities of our current system. Boxer is likely to push for some kind of greenhouse gas legislation. In fact, she's already introduced one version of a bill designed to do just that. Under her leadership, opening Anwar and the outer continental shelf to oil and gas drilling is much less likely, meaning those sources of domestic energy will not be available anytime soon. The House Committee on Energy and Commerce will be chaired by John Dingell from Michigan. He held this position for 16 years prior to 1994. And you might think that the Democrats, with their platform advocating energy conservation, would be in favor of raising fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. Well, most of them probably are, but not John Dingell. He's from Michigan, and he's beholden to the automobile industry, and he's been opposed to automobile efficiency standards for years. Since he'll control the Energy Committee, tough automobile efficiency standards are not likely to pass. So when you get right down to it, the Democratic Party's in a bit of a quandary. They want to limit greenhouse gases, but they won't force automobile efficiency standards. They want energy independence, but they won't allow drilling for domestic oil. That doesn't leave many options, does it? If they can curb the anti-nuclear faction within the party, then they might actually start supporting nuclear energy as part of the solution to reducing greenhouse gases and reducing reliance on foreign oil. They have to buck Harry Reid, though, because he's one of the shrinking minority of anti-nuclear radicals in Congress. Chairmanship of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources will pass from Senator Pete Domenici to Senator Jeff Bingaman, both of Nevada. Together, they addressed the American Nuclear Society this week, and I have a sound clip of their remarks for you. Senator Domenici went first, followed by Senator Bingaman. You'll hear them both make remarks about the importance of nuclear energy and the need for bipartisan support to resolve questions surrounding Yucca Mountain. Here's Senators Domenici and Bingaman.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm here. This is Pete. TV works well. My staff says that it's great. It's coming out right out of my office, so it's something new and exciting for both of us. And of course, Jeff's here with me. The correct protocol would have been to call on him first because he's chairman, but then he reminded me that technically he's not. I've got a couple more days of grace, and then you put the kibosh down, and that'll be the end of me. But he's not going to do that because we're going to try, I hope, to work together on some remaining great issues. We did one not too long ago when we passed the energy bill, and what a great excitement that was for us, for our committee, because we worked so long trying to get it done that it finally came about because we decided to forget about partisan politics and look at what we needed. Do I need to talk louder? Is that better if I talk at this? Okay, I'll be speaking about this okay for everybody? Can you tell me? All right. Well, let me just say that Albuquerque has been the city where you all have met more times than this one. And on previous occasions, we have not been had reason to be as excited as we are today. But today, clearly, your association knows that what you do and what you promote is now at the cutting edge of a renaissance in the production of nuclear power for the world. It's already alive and kicking and doing so very strong across other parts of the world, with Japan ordering some new ones, with China ordering large numbers of power plants, and India, and just on and on. And America sits here in a strange position for us. Just recently, if we would have met here, we would have had nothing going on. But now, with the passage of this act, this bipartisan act, we start today with, in the 15 months since Senator Bingaman and I have passed that energy bill, we've seen 31 planned applications for new nuclear power plants. The policies enacted in the energy bill made it necessary for nuclear power to have a chance to make a breakthrough. And what a breakthrough it will make. I think there should be a feeling around of a new nuclear horizon. The remaining issue is the issue of what do we do and what happens to nuclear waste. Well, I want to lay it right on the table. I believe that if our chairman will let us conduct hearings and we go forward, we will just have to see where the axe falls. We all know where I stand. We all know where others stand. But we also think we know where the new Democratic leader lies. He's from the state of Nevada. He has opposed Yucca for a long time. And I don't assume his becoming a chairman of the Democratic Party will have changed his mind. And he won't be running around saying, now that I have a little more power, I'm giving up. Quite the contrary, I think he will be there. Remember when he mentioned that he was a boxer once? He'll have both fists out, Jeff, on this one. And we'll just have to see how it comes out. You have seen or read the different approaches to how we move ahead. Mine says we've got to go ahead and use Yucca was intended, and do the best we can and move right ahead with it. There are a number of things that we'll have to do along with Yucca in order to make this work. But let me just leave that for another time, other than to say I think everybody knows what we have to do in order to get that done. This will take a number of hearings and perhaps take the first year of the next 2 years to get ourselves ready and mobilize legislatively, and then move ahead as rapidly as we can for the disposal part of this bill. In the meantime, let's hope the world moves ahead with nuclear power, and I believe that they will. I believe they have seen that the day, they have seen that there is no real alternative and there is no way to abandon it. It's too far along and too good, and we'll all see that play out soon. With that, thank you all. It's good to be with you again, as I have in the past, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Let me just start by saying what I think is obvious to everybody who's part of this conference, and that is that nuclear energy is a major source of carbon-free baseload energy. As our concern for the issue of global warming has increased and continues to increase, I think the emphasis on nuclear energy will grow accordingly, because it is carbon-free and it is baseload energy. I think there are several issues that face the nuclear power industry today and have faced it in recent years. In last year's energy bill, as Pete was pointing out in his comments, we tried to address several of those under his leadership. Three things in particular that we did in that bill that I think were intended to assist in this renaissance, as he's referred to it, of the nuclear industry here in the United States. First, we provided new authority for loan guarantees. Second, we provided a federally backed insurance program during the licensing of the first few reactors. We also, of course, provided a production tax credit for power produced from new reactors. That, I believe, is a significant factor as well. Let me just also add one comment on to what Senator Domenici said about the issue of nuclear waste. I do think that this is an issue that we need to have hearings on, and one that we need to try to come to some consensus on. There are several proposals pending in this Congress. It's a complex issue. The administration's got a proposal. I know Senator Domenici has a proposal. There's also some language that's been included in the Energy and Water bill that has been prepared here in the Senate. But I do believe this is a complex issue, but one where I think we need to try to struggle to find a consensus that we can then persuade a majority of members of Congress to go forward with. The issue is very important to the industry, very important to the future of nuclear power, and one that we can't just continue to defer action on. So I'm committed to trying to do what can be done in that area as well.
Again, that was Senators Domenici and Bingaman, the outgoing and the incoming chairman of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, addressing the 2006 winter meeting of the American Nuclear Society. They both called for congressional hearings to resolve questions surrounding the Yucca Mountain Project, and that'll be a good thing no matter how you slice it. So on the national level, things are not as bright as they were 2 weeks ago, but it's not all bad. In fact, call me an optimist. I believe that there's an opportunity here to develop a strategy on nuclear energy that both parties can get behind. If we can accomplish that, then the industry will benefit in the long run, because it will help demonstrate long-term sustainability in policy and legislation that the utilities and investors need to put the money on the table for new nuclear plants. I'll be keeping you up to date on things as they shake out in the new Congress. I want to say thanks to all of you who visited the new website at thisweekinnuclear.com and provided me with your feedback. You helped me to identify ways to improve the site and fix a broken link or two. I also discovered that the mobile version does not work on all cell phones or with all cell phone providers, and I'm trying to figure out why. I suspect it's the way the cell phones decode web pages, but I'm not sure. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I verified that all the links are properly working, so if you try the mobile version at thisweekinnuclear.com/mobile and it doesn't work, please send me an email telling me who your carrier is and what type of cell phone you're using. That might help me narrow down the problem. It also dawned on me this past week that the mobile site would be good for people who are on dial-up internet access because it's nothing but text and it'll load quickly, even if you have a low bitrate connection. So if you're on dial-up, give it a try and let me know how it works for you. This past week, I added a new feature that gives you another way to be a part of the show, a digital voice mailbox. If you call the voicemail number and leave a message, I can take it and insert it into the audio file for the show. The telephone number for the voice mailbox is area code 206-984-3654. If you're calling from outside the USA, then you'll have to add the country code. This new feature could be really useful if you have some interesting information or additional thoughts about a story I've discussed in the show. You can call and record your comments, and I'll add them to the show. Also, if you have a nuclear or energy-related website, podcast, or blog, then call and leave me a message, and I'll give you a chance to plug what you're doing. Hey, you can't beat an offer for free advertisement. I'm getting about 200 downloads a day on This Week in Nuclear, and it's steadily growing, so you'll be reaching a worldwide audience. So please call the mailbox and leave me a comment. I think it'll add a lot to the show to hear from you. Again, the phone number for the voicemail is area code 206-984-3654. There's no cost other than what your telephone service charges you for the call. One thing I find interesting is how many of my earlier shows are being downloaded. That indicates new listeners are joining in. When I combine that with other statistics, I get a pretty good picture of who's listening. For example, this week, I have new listeners in France, Chile, Argentina, Colombia, Liechtenstein, China, and Ireland. One new listener, Simon Filitro, wrote me an email suggesting that I discuss some of the new technologies surrounding waste disposal. Simon has a very interesting blog, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Simon, I'll do my best to cover that topic in the future. There's a huge body of knowledge on used nuclear fuel reprocessing and storage. It's not being well represented in the mainstream media, and I'd love to spend some time on that. Again, if you go to the show notes for this episode, you'll find a link to Simon's blog. Another technology that's gaining awareness is the abundance of uranium in seawater. There's enough uranium in the oceans of the world to power civilization for centuries, and it's not that costly to extract it, and I plan to cover that in a future episode. The anti-nuclear crowd wants people to believe that there's not enough uranium to go around, when in fact, uranium is amazingly abundant. But we'll have to save that for another show. My panel discussion this past week at the American Nuclear Society went great. If you were there, then I'd like to say thanks for a lively discussion about communicating in cyberspace. My partners there were Rod Adams of The Atomic Show and Eric McRelane of the NEI Nuclear Notes. They both do a fantastic job, and I encourage you to check out their respective websites. I posted a copy of my presentation to ANS on the homepage of my website, so if you'd like to take a look at what I discussed, you can find it there. As a reminder, there's a lot of information on the website at thisweekinnuclear.com. You can listen to prior episodes, read the show transcripts, post comments on my blog, search prior episodes, and learn more about podcasting on my podcasting tips page. You can also help support the show by using my shopping page or visiting some of the links on the various pages. I'd like to mention that with the holidays coming, if you plan to shop at Amazon.com, then please consider starting at my shopping page. I get a small percentage of any sales that originate from my store page, and it doesn't cost you any more than it would if you went straight to the Amazon homepage. You can shop for books, music, electronics, games, movies, just about anything else that's sold at Amazon.com. So why not support the show by pointing your browser to This Week in Nuclear and starting from there? Revenue from donations and advertisements still don't cover the expenses associated with the show, and I'd like to get it to the point where it's self-sustaining. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed episode number 36 of This Week in Nuclear. This is John Wheeler wishing you a safe and happy week. See you next time.